Happy New Year and welcome to the January 2012 edition of Book Talk from Scottish Book Trust. I'm Paul Gallagher, and this month I'm joined by the Scotsman features writer Lee Randall and freelance journalist and books blogger Nicola Balkind. Each month on Book Talk, we choose a book that we think is worth thinking about and discussing. And to begin this year, we've chosen one of the success stories of 2011, Jennifer Egan's Pulitzer Prize winner, A Visit from the Goon Squad. I'll find out in a moment what my guests thought of this incredibly ambitious book, as well as hearing their choices of related recommendations. But first, as it's the beginning of a new year, I thought I might start by asking you both if you have any particular books, new or old, that you're looking forward to reading this year. How about you, Lee?
I've just gotten my hands on a very early edition of Susan Orlean's Rin Tin Tin, the biography of the famous dog, or as it turns out, dogs, plural. And I'm hoping to also interview her this year, so I'm quite looking forward to cracking the spine on that.
Fantastic. Sounds good. How about you, Nicola?
I'm actually getting that one for Christmas as well. And I'm looking forward to reading The Art of Fielding by Chad Urbach, who's one of the founders of N+1, which is online. And it's been like a huge success story of the year. So since I've just watched Moneyball, I think I'll read that.
Visit from the Goon Squad is the fourth novel from Brooklyn-based writer Jennifer Egan. But for many readers, myself included, it's the first exposure they've had to her considerable writing talents. First published in the US in 2010, Goon Squad took a while to find an audience. But after winning the National Book Critics Circle Award and the aforementioned Pulitzer Prize for fiction, Egan's multi-stranded, sprawling story made its way into bestseller lists on both sides of the Atlantic and has remained there since. As I'm sure we'll get into in this discussion, the book is driven less by a progressing narrative or a central character than by several overriding themes. Passing time, changing relationships, and the nature of the music industry, to name a few. And Egan investigates these themes through 13 distinct chapters, each of which focuses on a different character, all of whom are in some way connected to each other. So, Lee, my first question to you is, what is this book? Is it a collection of short stories? Is it a novel? Or am I asking the wrong question?
I think it's a novel, although I've read some interviews in which Jennifer Egan herself questions whether it's a novel. But I think that our notion of what a novel is has to be quite elastic. I'm thinking of David Vann's Legend of a Suicide, which is several short stories, some of which tell the same story from a completely with different outcomes, which was also considered a novel. I think our definition of the novel has enough room in it to encompass this book.
So to ask a more specific question about your opinion on this book then, it's a novel. Is it a good one?
It's a very good one. It's very accomplished. I found it slightly self-conscious. I liked it very much. I admired it technically as somebody who writes for a living. I found myself drawn in by it. I didn't have a very big emotional response to it, but a lot of what's in there is really, really good. But some of what's in there I found a little show-offy.
Nicola, when I first started reading this book, as I got into the first few chapters, the first thing I thought was, if this is going to be a different chapter on each character, how am I ever really going to get invested in these people if all I'm finding out is one chapter's worth of information? Did you think Egan kind of faced up to that challenge, solved it, or was it a problem?
I think you could find it a problem early on, but as you go through the book, you kind of find that, you know, maybe someone they pass on the street or someone who's fairly incidental to the plot actually appears later as a main character. And I think that that was a great way of drawing you in, because a lot of the time it is a character who kind of catches your eye. And to come back to them later and learn more about them, you do become invested because you feel like you're learning almost about a completely different world, because they're connected in some way, but they have their whole own life to then explore. You will kind of find yourself attached to certain characters as you go through the book, and you almost kind of hope that they'll come back later, even though you know that they wouldn't necessarily narrate another chapter of their own.
Did either of you do what I did? I read it the first time front to back. I read it the second time back to front, although not exactly precisely. I found myself skipping back and forth because it's been likened to an iPod shuffle. And I found it worked equally well in either direction. So it's kind of like a palindrome almost. And I found that very interesting.
I first read this quite a few months ago, and then knowing that we were going to have the discussion, I reread it and found as soon as I started, I kind of wanted to jump ahead because I knew that some of these characters were going to come back. The point that you make brings up the issue of music. And I have mentioned in the introduction that music is one of the themes. It's been suggested that music is the main character in the book, but do you agree with that? Or more generally, Is there a main character in the book?
I think that music tells you what time it is. It tells you what year you're in or which memories someone's accessing. And I think that it's a really good counterpoint for that. For me, probably the main character was Benny. He seems to be kind of the centre of this microcosm that's happening. Towards the end of the book, it's then Sasha, who's his assistant. And I think partly that's just because I connected more with those characters than others. I wouldn't say there is a main character, but there are certainly characters who have stronger stories than others. And I think that they are the ones that will stick with you throughout.
So Benny is this music producer who's introduced in the sort of, he's named in the first chapter, but then he comes in the second chapter, which focuses on him. And then Sasha is his assistant, who the first chapter is about her. So Lee, what was your take on the idea of main characters in the book?
I don't think there is a main character because the book is so, I don't want to say gimmicky, but it has this shtick. Mm-hmm. I started wondering, well, maybe the reader is the main character. Maybe this is us tapping in and out of all different moments in existence that we may or may not relate to. Another really strong theme for me in this book is shame. First chapter, Sasha is ashamed of her kleptomania. The second chapter, Benny is creating a list of everything he's ashamed of. Dottie is very ashamed of losing his way in the industry, of losing his wife. Rhea is ashamed of almost everything, as you are at that awkward teenage age. Everybody's got some kind of shame they're working with.
I think that's a great point, but it's not one that I actually thought of while reading the book. And I think maybe that's an interesting thing about the book, is that there's quite a lot of different things that you can take from it, which perhaps slightly relates to what you were saying about maybe the reader being the main character.
No, but then I thought that was a bit pretentious. So.
One of the main things that stuck out for me was, along with the shame, is just this idea that everybody disintegrates and everybody becomes this empty shell as they get older. And, you know, like Jocelyn, who's Rhea's friend, Rhea really looks up to her and thinks that she's amazing and she's going out with this older guy. But when you meet her again later, she's just a shell of what she used to be. And she's so ashamed, as you said, to be older and more fragile. And she feels like she's missed out on something that everybody else had. And so there are a few characters who are a counterpoint to that, like the actress Kitty. And then to a certain extent, Jules, when he's younger, just the way he writes, they're very vibrant, but you kind of get a sense that things aren't going to go well for them. And there's all these kind of hints where it jumps into the future and tells you, you know, this is what happens to this person in the future. Yeah. And that really taints what you're reading at that moment, and it imbues it with a sadness that you just can't escape.
I think it's Alex who says, I wrote this down, people who had stopped being themselves without realizing it. Mm-hmm. But the whole book is about the whole point of how do we get from A to B, which one of the characters also articulates. I think it's also about growing up. I'm slightly older than the Benny group of characters, but I really remembered that sense of recklessness when you're very young, when you think you're immortal and you don't know where you're going to wake up in the morning or with who or what chemicals are going to be in your system or how you're going to pay the bills the next day, and it doesn't matter. And then time marches on.
And that brings me to another point I was going to bring up, which was the book begins with two quotes from Proust. And this issue of time is obviously, you know, Jennifer Egan wants us to think about that as we read. And there's these two quotes, one of which talks about the places of our youth, and the other one which talks about the unknown element of the lives of other people. And I wondered, Nicola, what kind of bearing does that have on your reading of the book? I mean, we've already mentioned time, but what else is in there that Egan's kind of wanting us to think about, I guess, as we read?
I think there were kind of a lot of harking back and harking forward almost. Benny's got all this shame about his past, and he's got this lost desire that he's trying to recapture in just these kind of pathetic ways because he doesn't know how to connect with people anymore. And then you've got like Scotty, who's scarred his eyes staring at the sun, and that's something that comes back up later on. And I feel like there are all these moments in people's lives rather than necessarily places that they're always looking back to or hoping will happen to them in order to make them happy, but you kind of can see that that's not going to happen.
I mean, Lee, would you agree with that? Kind of, that's what those Proust quotes are kind of getting at.
I never know what quotes at the start of a book are getting at, but it's a bit like when you, again, let's use a music metaphor. If a band has chosen the music that's playing as people are filling into the stadium, they're creating a mood. So you read those two quotes a bit quickly, and already your head's pointed the right direction. It's pointed the direction Jennifer Egan wants you to face rather than just wandering in off the street, looking around and not knowing where to focus. So for me, that's how they function.
I think the second quote about the unknown element of the lives of others, I think that that's really captured in the Jules chapter where he's going to meet Kitty to interview her and he wants to know something about her life that nobody's tapped into before and goes a very strange way about trying to trying to do that. And even the bit about fresh scientific discovery, there's that whole footnote where he's talking about molecules and how they bond and he makes this metaphor that doesn't actually make sense because it's something in science that hasn't been fully explored yet.
Did you not also think of that moment in Mrs. Dalloway where Clarissa hears about somebody she used to hang out with as a young woman and she is gobsmacked that they carried on having a rich and full life without her even being aware of it. And that kept echoing through the book for me as well, in both directions.
Yes, and that idea of, like, you're the main character in your own story is one that she's kind of, I think, trying to find a way to break free from, like, and having all these different chapters about these different characters and you see them from someone else's perspective and then see their own. She seems to be attempting to almost defy the Proust quote and say, this is the inner lives of the people. So I suppose, Lee, you said that you felt that you didn't really get that connection with those characters. Is Egan successful if she's trying to get into these lives, or is it something where it's stylistically successful but perhaps not quite getting at what she wants?
It could simply be that what she was doing didn't speak to me emotionally. As I say, I did admire the book, but I read a lot, you know, you can't help but read the reviews, and they're all talking about, you know, how searingly moving and emotional it is, and I thought, nah, not moved, not emotional. Yes, flashes of recognition, yes, laughed out loud several times, but not that I didn't care about the characters, just that I didn't care enough.
For me, the chapter that is the most kind of stylistically audacious, the second last chapter of the book, is told as a series of PowerPoint slides. I actually found that one of the most moving chapters of the book, which is perhaps quite surprising. I wondered, was that a gimmicky thing, or did you find there was surprising emotion coming through there? How did you sort of find all of these elements?
I think that the reason the PowerPoint slides worked was because it was kind of from a child's point of view, and you do feel like she's articulate and she knows good ways to get her message across, but this is just kind of a fun thing that she does, and so a lot of the things that she brings up feel very poignant. It's very incongruous the way you read it, because it's kind of, you know, PowerPoints are either very serious in a business way or they're kind of playful with these funny shapes that look like bubbles and things like that. And so for her to be putting down very serious emotions and knowing as well that her mother thinks that it's kind of silly and that she should be writing stories instead, I think that that's where that power really comes from.
And there's also, I mean, Lee, I don't know if you can say how you feel about the PowerPoint section, but I think by that point in the book, we know Sasha, who is kind of a key character you can't help but take on everything that you already know about her and sort of invest that into this new information you're getting. But you look like perhaps you disagree with me.
That's if you read it front to back. The second time I read the book, that was the second chapter I read. So then I went back with Sasha. You know, you go back to Naples, you go back to New York City. But I thought the PowerPoint section worked beautifully because exactly what you're saying, Nicola, about the child's perspective, because so much is left out, it absolutely paralleled the gaps in Allison's understanding. She's like, this is happening. I don't know what that's about, but I'm going to put it down because it seems important. I thought it was just the absolute right way to handle that.
Mentioning gaps, that chapter is called Great Pauses in Rock and Roll. This brings us back to music. To me, it's sort of a perfect metaphor for what Egan's trying to do, because a pause in a song is like a perfect way to measure an exact space of time. And that is what she's trying to do in this book and capture time. Did you get that? And on the wider scale, do you agree that this is a book that is kind of about music in some way as well?
I think it's about music to a certain extent. As I said, it is very much tied to time and memories. You've got Benny telling stories through music all the time, and he's never entirely sure if people understand his point that he's trying to get across through those songs. And that's almost a kind of punctuation in itself as well, that he hopes that people know what he's talking about when he plays them a few songs in a row. But then when it seems like they know what he's talking about, he kind of freaks out a bit.
And the pause is the space between A and B, which is the space she's pondering. It's also they say in that chapter, you think it's all over, but it's not. Again, you think someone's life is over because they've gone out of your view, but in fact, it is going on all over the place, just without you.
Ali, I know because you commented before we started recording that you kind of have an issue with me saying that music is a theme of
it's
the book.
It's not you, it's everyone. Everyone is saying it's a book about music. Music is in some of the chapters, but it's not in every chapter. It could be as much a book about technology, it could be as much a book about the media. Those things are just as strong, just as vital, and I don't know why everyone's calling it a music book.
Well, there is the idea as well, like, and I think after I read this first time, I kind of felt quite pleased with myself at thinking, hey, this is almost like an album. So, like, we've got 13 chapters, which could be like 13 tracks. You could shuffle them like you're listening to music. Half of the book is called A, the other half is called B. Nicola, what does that actually add to the book, apart from it being quite cool?
I think it allows you to experience the book in many different ways. I know from reading it through a second time, there were things that had stuck out in my mind, but they were actually in a different order than I remembered them. And so even just going back with knowledge of certain characters that you don't learn till later and bringing it all the way back to the beginning again, depending on the order you read it in, it'll hit different notes.
And Lee, like an album then, could it be that there might be a particular chapter in here that is far and away one's favourite chapter that you might even want to reread as a separate story in its own right?
Yes, I don't think every single chapter answers the definition of a short story, but they certainly work as short tales. And I also think, like an album, if I pick this book up again in 10 years' time, I might find chapters 13 and 2 spoke to me, whereas now at this age I am now, it's chapters, you know, 5 and 6. It's that fluidity.
The last chapter is set furthest in the future of any of the chapters and seems to make some pretty damning predictions about the music industry. Do you think that Jennifer Egan is just kind of having some fun with some possibilities, or do you think maybe she really is saying, well, maybe in not too long, all music is just going to be aimed at babies?
It's certainly the way that cinema seems to be going these days. It's almost that kind of Margaret Atwood way that she builds a dystopic future by taking all the things that she doesn't like about society at the time and just exaggerating them. And it was a similar kind of idea to that, I felt, the way that she put that across.
And did you think, Lee, that was kind of prescient, or was it?
Well, to be honest, my first reaction was, why can't somebody write a novel set in the future where everyone's happy? That was my first reaction. And then I thought, no, I could see what she's riffing. She's riffing, to use a musical term, on what have we got now and where might it go?
And do you think, just as we kind of come to the end of this segment, we've talked about how it's about time passing and aging, certainly, and those kind of things. Do you think that there's an overall kind of melancholic bent to the book, or is there strains of hope? What kind of tone, if you could pull one out, is this really kind of leaving you with, Lee?
I felt very much that it was a satirical book, and that at times it verged on being as cynical as the thing it was satirizing.
I think it is very cynical, and like you said, it kind of does what it's making fun of in a way. But overall, the tone wasn't nearly as sad as when you dig deeper. So I think in a way it was kind of like that cynical New Yorker thing. Like the first two chapters especially, they feel very New York and very kind of, you know, it's these people who have these great jobs and weird home lives, and they've got all these secret problems they have to get their head shrunk about. And I think that that's the tone that it really hits at the beginning, and it does kind of waver as it goes along. And again, it depends which order you read it and what note you'll end on.
Okay, so those are our initial thoughts on A Visit from the Goon Squad. We're going to continue discussing the book and some of its wider themes in just a moment, so don't go away. This is Book Talk. I'm Paul Gallagher. I'm here with Lee Randall and Nicola Balkin discussing A Visit from the Goon Squad by Jennifer Egan. I'd like to talk about a couple of criticisms the book's received. The Independent said that the book is seductive and brilliant, but its fractured surface hides a meticulous organization. Basically, they were kind of criticizing the book for being telescopic in scope, not as wide as it initially seems to be, because everything is actually quite linearly connected. Nicola, is that a criticism that holds weight with you?
I think so. I think when you try to make a story that has so many characters that are all in some way connected and not just they saw each other across the street, you're always going to have that problem. It wasn't as obvious as, you know, like the film Crash, for example, has loads of connections that are just almost too good to be true. But when you have a group of characters who all live in the same city, I think that's bound to happen. And I know that Jennifer Egan had a lot of rules for herself about writing about a character once from their perspective each, the kind of length of the stories and stuff like that. So I think that that's a symptom of that as well.
Do you really that that's kind of... that really it is quite a sort of engineered...
Yeah,
sort of
well, I guess thing. I think that's why I was talking about it being self-conscious, but it never occurred to me that it was supposed to be taking in the whole world. I thought it was looking at something quite specific, and it looked at it from all angles. It reminded me there's a style of painting where you take glazes and you build the picture up by washing the canvas with just one color and then another color and another color, and you have to wait in between for each glaze to dry. And it reminded me exactly of that. You seem to be doing this great wash, but you're just doing it in a specific place to create a specific effect.
Another thing that's really quite prominent in the book is that the stories all, to greater or lesser extents, reflect a kind of uneasy relationship with technology. The digitization of music is quite lamented through Benny's character and Sasha to an extent. But then the book itself is almost like a product of technology, like you can shuffle it. And Nicola, did you find any kind of messages about technology and the way it's shaping our lives?
Definitely. I think it was all very much reflected by all the characters getting older and feeling a bit like they couldn't keep up. You've got Benny who leaves things behind all the time and doesn't even realise they're missing until Sasha hands them to him. And I think that that's reflected later when, you know, people are fiddling with their phones at this concert trying to work out how to text, and they've got this weird text speak that's very phonetic. The points that they made about music and the digitization, you don't have the same kind of anticipation of the pause because you can just hit pause on the player. I think that was, it made a good point, but at the same time it didn't really land for me.
Because Lee, the book is, I mean, Egan and many of the characters in the book are kind of in love with technology as well, aren't they?
Well, technology is so ingrained in our lives now. I think that I remember no internet. I remember when mobile phones were invented. That's how old I am, you know? And yet I see how seamlessly they've woven their way into my life. Mm. I kept thinking of, I've read enough to know that Egan herself does not tweet very often, but it struck me that apart from obviously Pulp Fiction, which not only told multiple stories, but told them in reverse order, sometimes no order, I thought it actually owed a debt to Twitter, because on Twitter you can have 150, 300 narratives going on the trot, and then you find out that, oh, these 10 people you follow also follow those 10 people. So those stories start intermingling and overlapping. Technology has prepared us for books like this.
So maybe Jennifer Egan should really get on Twitter.
She's on Twitter. She just doesn't use it much.
Yeah.
When the book tanked initially, sales-wise, and then she started getting good reviews, what she did is she started working the media, which, again, is another theme in the book. And she started a Facebook campaign, and she started... And I don't say that with any, again, negativity.
Yeah.
She started generating buzz for the book using social media. Yeah. So I don't think she's necessarily anti it, but... You can see what she's talking about. You know, there is that question of characters who tweet each other across the table. What if I was tweeting in this podcast to you sitting across the table from me? That would be bonkers. So there are bonkers elements to it.
Just as you mentioned it there, like the kind of tweeting each other or sending direct messages to each other instead of talking. The fact that it's sometimes preferable to like text somebody than actually have a conversation with them, even though that text form of communication is so much more open to misunderstanding than sitting and talking to someone.
We've been prepared for this sort of narrative for some time, but this is the first one to really take it and run with it. And it's interesting that you mentioned Pulp Fiction as well, because she actually did a screening in about April in New York of Pulp Fiction, because she'd seen it in like 1994 or something, and she knew that something had struck her about the linearity of Pulp Fiction. And it's interesting because it's now been, someone posted it in chronological order recently on the internet. She actually, at her screening, said, "I didn't realise how much it had affected me, and I even have a character called Jules, what's that all about?" And I think that that's really interesting, because maybe she doesn't realise quite how much technology has allowed her to write this book.
Yeah.
And it's this thing that she's absorbed without really actually examining it.
Or maybe she does, and it's simply the characters who feel the problem with it. It's, you know, it's hard to... I do this as well, but it's that scary thing of, okay, she's not her character.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Although she does write longhand. She doesn't write on a word processor.
She does sound like a bit
of a... Maybe she is her character.
Well, if you've read A Visit from the Goon Squad and want to add your comments to the discussion, go to the website at scottishbooktrust.com/booktalk and add your comments directly to the page. And you can check us out on Twitter at booktalk_SBT. And if you want to find us on Facebook, check out the links from the webpage, scottishbooktrust.com/booktalk. You can also email us at booktalk@scottishbooktrust.com with thoughts on A Visit from the Goon Squad or any other books, or if you want to suggest a future book for us to talk about. We move finally into our related recommendations section, where we take the idea that one book leads to another and think about the other books that we were put in mind of while reading A Visit from the Goon Squad and that we'd also recommend. So Lee, what would be on your list?
A couple of things. I mean, she herself talked about Middlemarch and Cervantes both as people who were able to deal with multiple narratives and give a great big picture by showing many, many lives. The Slap, again, a book that goes from start to finish, but you never go back to the same narrator twice. I thought if your goal is to read something that slightly takes the novel structure and spins it on its head, Steve Hall's The Rorschach Text was one of my favorite books the year I read it. And finally, if you just wanted to read about the music scene, there's that wonderful book, Please Kill Me, which is nonfiction, and it's an oral history of the American punk rock scene. I can't remember the author, but you'll find it if you Google it.
And another one that I would throw in, which I read after reading this, and then a section of it actually reminded me of it, is Jennifer Egan's previous book, The Keep. The chapter in Goon Squad about Lou on safari does a similar thing to The Keep, where it's a little sort of mini society of people thrown together, and there's possible suspicion of someone having an affair with someone else, or these attractions between couples. And there's a similar setup in The Keep, although, as with Goon Squad, it's not as simple as that. There is another layer of story as well. And Jennifer Egan does it really well. And it's different to Visit from the Goon Squad, but similar in ways that really make me see that she's a great writer. So I would definitely recommend checking that out, particularly if you like Goon Squad. Nicola, how about you?
I was put in mind of Juno Diaz, who actually won the Pulitzer a couple of years ago with The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde. It's kind of a similar story in that it's got a main character, but then there are all these histories, family history and greater history, that are all told from various narrators of people in his life. And there's a lot of kind of footnotes going on in there as well. He's also got short stories called Drown, which are based around a community of Dominicans in New York City, and there are a lot of stories where several different characters pop up in different stories, and those are all very vivid, and I love his writing. For kind of mental breakdowns, I would suggest Augustine Burroughs' Cellavision, which is very cynical and very outlandish and extremely funny. And then for the kind of life journeys, I guess, I'd suggest The Marriage Plot, which is Jeffrey Eugenides' new book, which is more about postgraduate life and drifting, which is something that isn't quite captured in the book. It's more of an in-between. And finally, there are a couple by Laurie Moore that I would suggest. She has one story that I think is called Being the Other Woman, which is written in second person narration, so that's an interesting one to check out. And also her short novel, which is called Who'll Run the Frog Hospital, which reminded me a lot of Jocelyn and Ray's their relationship.
Excellent choices. We will stick those all up on the website, and so if you want to find out more about any of those related recommendations, go to scottishbooktrust.com/booktalk and you'll find them all there. Also, you can find our interview with Jennifer Egan there, all about the development and writing of A Visit from the Goon Squad. And please get in touch and let us know your verdict on the book. I'll be back next month with another book talk when we'll be discussing the debut novel from Scottish writer Sue Peebles, The Death of Loman Friel. Don't miss it. Thanks to my guests, Lee Randall and Nicola Balkind. For Scottish Book Trust, I'm Paul Gallagher. Goodbye. Book Talk is produced by Colin Fraser, with music by Sam Gallagher.